This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here again with Anatoly Karlin, and we're going to continue our discussion on the coronavirus pandemic. Anatoly, great having you back on, and what are the most notable things that have happened since the last time we talked?
Well, thank you, Robert. It's great to have you back on as well. So what's been happening? Well, the numbers have been going sharply up. Congratulations on becoming number one in the world. That's quite an impressive achievement.
United States is number one in the world. It was about 2 to 3 days ago since we're recording this show at about 100,000. I think now the current number for the United States is about approaching 120,000.
As of right now, it's 135,000.
Oh, right.
Yeah, 2,300 deaths. Probably tomorrow the U.S. will overtake Iran and France.
So, yeah, what's interesting is with cases, so if you compare the cases, United States is number one in cases, but it's not. Italy is still ahead in death, so the death rate is still much lower in the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously good, but it's extremely unlikely to last because the epidemic is younger in the U.S. So as time goes on, a lot of the older cases will start dying. So this is, I assume, one of the things you want to talk about. But basically, if you look at the death rate in South Korea, which contained its epidemic, so it's pretty much all in the past now. It's been slowly but inexorably creeping up to a CFR case fatality ratio of 2%. And that's despite the fact that South Korea's hospital system was never overwhelmed or at serious risk of being overwhelmed. It's got the world's second largest number of hospital beds per capita after Japan. Its healthcare system itself is world class, obviously. So if it's 2% there, then it's probably pretty much sets a lower limit on how many people are going to die on average.
Yeah, because as there's a shortage of ICUs, that's what would dramatically lead to an increase in the death rates.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically what it looks like back when the pandemic started, I estimated that the CFR would be around 1%. Looks like it will really be around 2%. And if, with medical care, obviously. And without medical care, it looks like it's going to be around 5%. Formerly in China, the death rate was, I believe it was 0.7% outside Hubei, but that was like several weeks ago. And it was 3.8% within Hubei, which is where the healthcare system got overwhelmed. So that's a differential of a fivefold difference.
Oh, what precautions have proven to be effective, including testing, quarantines, and wearing masks?
Well, yeah, it's extremely frustrating because a surgical mask costs it literally costs 5 cents to manufacture, and if you look at the wide range of studies, they really are very effective, and it's pretty amazing that the reason we have these exploding epidemics in in Europe and the US relative to East Asia is probably like the primary reason actually is the lack of personal protective equipment such as masks, or like firstly the shortages in the pharmacies, and secondly the fact that it's not socially acceptable to wear them. At least it wasn't a few as of a few days ago. It seems like things are slowly beginning to change.
So yeah, I was talking to a friend in LA, and he was saying at the supermarkets there, the rate of wearing face masks is about 50% now, and here in Santa Barbara, it's much lower than that even.
Mm-hmm. I imagine in Santa Barbara, there's not such a big epidemic, or is there?
Yeah, Santa Barbara County, it's about 60 cases in the whole county, and in Santa Barbara itself, it's still in the official cases. Obviously, there's more cases that haven't been counted. But the official cases in Santa Barbara itself are only about 20 something. So it's not that bad in comparison.
So there's a German university which has a cool GIF where they show where you if you're not wearing a mask and you sneeze, then it like this steam of air basically goes several meters in front of you. And if you're wearing a mask, then it pretty much blocks the door solid. That's a big difference. And another thing is that I was actually discussing this on another podcast, Russian language podcast recently, is that there's obviously many other things you can do. So the West over the past decade has built a vast network of surveillance mechanisms, such as cameras peppered throughout the big cities. And if you link them to facial recognition software, then that's one method of locating people who break quarantine, for instance. And you also know the location of people, geolocation via their cell phone signals at any one time. So using that, it's now very easy to build a history of where people were. And if someone later tests positive for corona, you could send out messages informing people that that they've been exposed, so they should check up on themselves. So all of these measures were implemented in Taiwan, in South Korea, in Singapore, but I don't think there's really any evidence that they've been are they being implemented en masse in any Western country?
No, I don't think so. It's all a personal... Yeah, it's still based on, like, a personal decision. No, I'm not aware of any Western country where it's being implemented as state policy en masse.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the recent charts on growth rates by countries? Exponential growth acceleration versus where there's stabilization. There's obviously... Well, there's these charts, they show nations, and then there's some that are regional based. So there's the one chart that I've been seeing a lot on Twitter that shows... It shows New York, it shows London, Paris, California, Milan.
Mm-hmm. Obviously the exponential, it differs from country to country. It's very bad in the US and in Turkey, so it's exploding very fast. Although, as we discussed, very fast growth in the U.S. is probably partly a function of the U.S. beginning to test very widely in the past 2 weeks. The U.S. Was once a huge laggard in testing, and now it's done more tests than any other country now. It's approaching a million tests. So obviously the U.S. has started catching all the people who it previously hadn't.
I've heard estimates that death rates in Italy and other places are much higher than the official numbers.
Yeah, there was an Italian person who did some calculations. He looked at, he gathered data for a bunch of small towns in Lombardy and the Veneto region. And basically this March, precisely, there have been on average five times as many deaths as there were in those previous years. Coronavirus is the obvious candidate which caused deaths to be much higher. And if you could extrapolate these figures to Italy as a whole, then it's entirely possible that up to 50,000 people may have died from coronavirus in Italy as opposed to the official 10,000. Although we should treat that with caution because he was I mean there was a it was journalists who identified these discrepancies in the first place, and it's quite probable, I imagine, that they focused on the worst hit areas.
Is there any logic behind that theory that's been going around that the majority of the populace is already infected?
Yeah, there's been a study about that, and I think it's frankly nonsense. Because if you posit that a large percentage of the population has already been infected, as is done in this Oxford University study. Then how do you explain hotspots in principle? So if it's spread, then why do people not particularly die anywhere? But why do you have Wuhan? Why do you have Lombardy? Why do you have New York City, where deaths soar upwards? How do you explain that?
Oh, how do you explain the exponential growth rates of the deaths?
Well, no. I'm just saying that if everybody is infected, then you would logically expect the entire world to start becoming like Wuhan was in February, or like Lombardy or New York City are right now. But that's obviously not happening.
Yeah, for that to happen, like you would have to have all these massive cases without symptoms. So yeah, that doesn't. Yeah, I'm incredibly skeptical of that theory. What's interesting is there are these tracking estimates, predictions. I know Robin Hanson has a chart he posted on predicting the chances of the worst-case scenario of 10 million deaths by January 2021. Obviously, I don't think it's going to get anywhere near that, but is that the scenario if we do absolutely nothing?
I mean, if we do absolutely nothing, then the R0 of... the novel coronavirus has been estimated at 3 to 4. So in a do nothing scenario with no quarantines, no lockdowns, no social measures such as people starting to wear masks and so on, social distancing, then you would expect at an equilibrium level for 66% to 75% of the population to be infected. In the world, so that would be there's how many 7.5 billion people. Well, 2/3 of them would be 5 billion. 5 billion times 2% is 100 million. That's the 2% is the one where everybody gets medical treatment, but which is pretty unrealistic in such a scenario. But yeah, anyway, 100 million people. So it's entirely realistic, I think, if there's no control measures. Obviously, the control measures will strongly dampen the worst-case scenario.
Do you have any personal estimates of what the death toll will be in, say, by January 2021?
It really depends on whether the U.S. will be successful or not at locking down New York. So, I mean, even Trump has started talking about that now. Whether that will actually go ahead or not is another question. I'd imagine that there'd eventually be a few... at the rate things are going, so just extrapolating the sorts of... measures that have been taken so far, or that are not taken, I'd expect several hundred thousand deaths in the U.S.
That's your personal prediction: several hundred thousand deaths in the U.S.
If things don't radically improve in the next few weeks, as I'm talking about lockdowns, I'm talking about much greater availability of personal protective equipment and so on.
And there's also uncertainty whether the warm weather in the summer will have an impact, or this could continue well into the summer. Or there's another theory that it could simmer down in the summer, and there could be a second wave in the fall.
Well, yeah, I mean, the coronavirus seems to prefer dry weather and temperatures of 5 degrees, 10 degrees Celsius. But, and I mean, people were hoping a lot that this was like a hard rule a month ago. But since then, we've discovered that we shouldn't rely on that because tons of countries in the global south are now getting infected and starting to have epidemics. It's not a hard and fast barrier. The temperatures aren't a hard barrier to the coronavirus.
Yeah, in the southern hemisphere, it's not as bad, but it's still growing in Brazil and Australia. So when they have their winter in our summer, it's possible it could get worse there at that time.
Mm. At any rate, there's a website called Election Betting Odds, and they recently created a new category for just the coronavirus. And the according to the gamblers, there's a 72% chance now, according to people who bet on this, that there'll be more than 1 million confirmed cases in the US by April 15th.
You posted on UNS flight tracking radar maps. What are some of the noticeable trends?
Well, the noticeable trends, just looking at that map, is that there's much fewer air flights right now than there were half a year ago during normal times, and with the sole exception of the US, which is still peppered with flights. So obviously the, you've heard the news, China has closed its doors again.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not letting in foreigners. Actually, I predicted in my post on Corona will kill millions and create the world economy, which was from February 24th. I predicted that even though the East Asians control the infections, they'd start getting reinfected by epidemics elsewhere. And we see exactly that happening. So China has closed its borders, and now Japan says that it will close its borders to Americans next week. Anyway, you have all these countries closing their borders. The EU is pretty much locked down. Russia has stopped flights, foreign flights, not domestic ones. But all of Eurasia is pretty much a dark zone now. That's so far as flights are concerned. And according to flight leader statistics, something like a third of all the flights in the world currently occurring are happening in the U.S. right now, over U.S. skies.
As far as inaccurate information going out about the coronavirus, how much of it is inaccurate? What are the sources of fake news? And is fake news the danger, or do you think it's more the establishment wants to control the narrative?
Well, I mean, here's the elementary thing. The Western leaders, generally speaking, have fucked up on an epic scale. When that happens, you need to blame somebody. And that's especially the case for people like Trump, who actually spent much of the past month, much of February, saying it's a hoax, so that it's the Chinese virus, that it's not going to affect the U.S., that we've got very beautiful numbers and so on. In Britain, you had Bojo saying that, talking that he was going to do herd immunity, and then they realized it was a shit idea, and they had to sharply reverse course on that. So that was, again, a lot of time lost. So obviously, they need to ascribe blame to somebody. And the logical sort of shelling point for ascribing blame would logically be China, because first of all, it's easy, the epidemic started there, and secondly, they do have a limited point in that the Chinese did indeed weren't entirely transparent about communicating what was happening. It's logical, and we should expect it. And there's also other types of fake news. So, for instance, Russia sent some ventilators to Italy, 600 ventilators, and there was a rumor going down that 80% of them were broken, even though the Italians themselves denied it, but it was widely reprinted in the Western media. So, China, to a lesser extent Russia, they're going to be trying to strike political points of this. And like the US primarily will be trying to prevent them from taking advantage too much of this sort of failure of on their part.
On the last time we talked, we discussed Trump's Catch-22, basically about how he had to choose between cratering the economy and not doing anything and the situation getting out of control. So, and now, well, Trump made that comment that he wants the economy to be reopened by Easter. What are your overall thoughts on Trump's handling of the economy?
I mean, I think it's a false dichotomy because even if he reopens the U.S., if the entire world in the meantime is shutting down, and if people are too scared to go to restaurants, to cinemas, and so on anyway, then what difference does it make? You're going to be having a recession anyway. And at least with a sharp lockdown, you can weather a very, very sharp downturn for a few months, so like 2 or 3 months, and then reopen them. So that's basically what China did. They sharply closed down in late January and in February, and now they're opening back up again. Well, what this does, I don't think it will actually alleviate the pain so much as just stretch it out. And if you think about it, it's actually worse for Trump, because if he gets it over with now, but actually beats the corona epidemic, then once the elections come rolling, the economy will, there's actually a chance that it might be growing again. Whereas if it's stretched out, it's not going to be growing, and you also have tons of deaths into the bargain. Which is why actually Don Unz on his blog, the Unz Review, his website, he predicted that Trump is going to ignore his promise to reopen the economy on April 12th and just quietly forget about that. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, it really does show the fragility of our economic system if quarantine would cause an economic collapse. Because the thing is, in the past, there was this tradition of shutting down economies for religious holidays. In the Spanish flu, that in 1919, the economy ended up doing pretty well in the 1920s. It had an economic impact, but it wasn't devastating like a major depression. So it does really show the fragility of our current economic model. How have other nations done economically with their quarantines?
I mean, I think it's generally too early to say. I mean, the one example we have is East Asia so far. So China, as you know, they locked down a bunch of cities and the economic output did indeed collapse there during February. You had 80% fewer cars sold in all of China in February relative to the past year. But now they're starting the factories up again. But ironically, the demand is collapsing in the Western world now. So it doesn't look like the Chinese are going to start up their economy to what it was. So like if they fell from like 100% to 50% production in February, they'll probably only get it back to 80% because the US isn't going to be importing anything now, or Europe. And we also have examples in South Korea, Japan, and so on, but the epidemics there were too small scale to really make a huge economic difference. I mean, they handled their breakouts without the draconian measures that China had to resort to get Hubei under control.
Do you have economic predictions on the chance of a major economic catastrophe, a depression?
I mean, I was saying that that there'd be an economic depression in February. So yeah, I mean, I imagine so. I think that the U.S. economy will collapse will decline by at least 5% this year, perhaps as high as much as 10%.
There. So we did touch upon the proposed UBI the last time we talked. Yang has been talking this a long time. Tulsi Gabbard proposed a bill, And there was this hope that Trump would give out, would get, like, people were talking about, were memeing Trump bucks, and that Trump would give out a basic income. And I think that would have been, like, there's all this disappointment with Trump. Not so much from mainstream, he's popular among mainstream conservatives, but among dissidents. And I think that could have been a major chance for Trump to reinvent himself and build a new coalition that would bring in a lot of the Bernie bros, the Yang Gang, and like rebuilding a new kind of populist coalition. And there were actually some prominent Republicans proposing at least an emergency UBI. But what ended up happening is there was a $2 trillion bailout. The very minimum, there'll probably be much more of the major corporations, and the amount that ordinary citizens, it could very well just be a tax rebate, but it's something incredible. It's just a one-time payout of $1,200. So that's hardly anything. Well, the major corporations.
Oh yeah, I mean, for many people, it's just 1 month's rent. Yeah, I mean, if they've lost a job, they'll be able to pay rent for a month. Although in fairness, the rents have been frozen, right? Or has that not passed yet?
No, that hasn't passed. It's being done for. So rent freezes are being done on a local level, but there hasn't been done federally yet.
Okay. Obviously he missed a big chance to sort of flip the situation around. I mean, if he wanted to win, then he'd have swallowed a hard economic collapse, but then restored, but given the economy room to restore itself in another 3 or 4 months in time for the election, and actually made sure that people weathered the payroll, right, by pushing for UBI, because if there's any time at which it's very legitimate to make the printer go bull with money, it's right now. I mean, the velocity of money must be down by twofold or something. So yeah, just print money. Nothing will happen if you do it now. We're getting the same old bailouts that happened in 2008, and which nobody really cares for. And the championing of the Dow Jones, if by some miracle the Dow Jones does now recover and start going back up, then yeah, maybe he'll do well in the elections. But that seems like a bit nonsensical prospect. And another thing I noticed, by the way, just one thing I want to add is that the MAGA people on Twitter, they're now dancing about how Trump is becoming much more popular. His approval rating is up to 46% now or something, and the majority of Americans approve of how he's handling coronavirus. That's another one of the, another bizarre delusion born out of the sort of parochialism of these people. Because if you look at the approval ratings of foreign leaders, most of them have gone up by a lot more than the 5 percentage points that Trump has. So Trump went from 42% or whatever to 46%, whereas Merkel, she was at somewhere 50% something 3 or 4 months ago, and now she's at almost 80%. So there's a rally around the flag all the time whenever there's a big crisis, 9/11, the eve of the Iraq war and so on, but it fades pretty quickly. And Trump's gain of 5 percentage points, that it's pretty, well sad actually, relative to other examples.
And there is a major political divide in the United States where conservatives and red state governors are not taking it as seriously. And definitely Democrats and blue state governors are taking this situation more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's this sort of blue type versus red type thinking that that Scott Alexander described and which we discussed a few times on this podcast. So there's a set of religious beliefs that each type has to subscribe to. So the blue type, they believe that genetics doesn't apply to intelligence, that we're all biologically equal, the diet believes that global warming is a globalist hoax, and it seems that coronavirus has also decided to divide like along ideological lines, with the Republicans saying it's not a big deal, a nothing burger or a hoax, and with Democrats actually being pretty level-headed about it.
It is interesting that there is this anti-Trump dissident right, which would include Richard Spencer, and their position is generally aligned with the mainstream left, that we do need to take the quarantine much more seriously, and that Trump and Republicans are not serious at all. Have you noticed that trend?
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, we joked. One thing I noted, actually, is that, Paul, those Paul memes about boomer genocide and the Day of the Pillow and so on. And it's actually completely ironic if you think about it, because the sort of respectable conservatives, they were like really triggered by those sort of Day of the Pillow jokes. And now we discover that they're entirely unironic about boomer genocide.
Yeah, that's ironic too. It's actually the dissident right or alt-right types that normally would bash boomers are taking the quarantine more seriously, when a lot of these like more boomer conservative types are the ones who are not. That's another irony.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that. The dissident right, they are probably more intelligent, more cosmopolitan, ironically enough, than the basic bitch, MAGA, conservative sort of, you know, pundits. And a lot of them are basically grifters, like that Bill Mitchell person.
Oh, yeah.
Either cynical grifters or just really dumb, actually. I mean, I think it's one of the two. So, you know how when they had those briefings on the coronavirus about 2 weeks ago now, and a bunch of them started insider trading while their sort of minions, alt-right minions, continued talking of the economy. So Eric Trump was tweeting how now is the time to go big on the Dow Jones and stuff like that, you know.
Do you have any thoughts on the ideological patterns of the government's responses to coronavirus, including right-wingers like Bolsonaro and some of the more neoliberal regimes?
Mm-hmm. I mean, funnily enough, I don't think there's any strong pattern. So Bolsonaro, who's the sponsor, is perhaps even sort of dumber than Trump's. He's they're both right-wing populists. On the other hand, India's Modi is taking it very seriously.
Yeah, and also Orban too in Hungary.
Although Hungary could test more people, but they've been better than average. And I mean, Russia isn't always included in this group, but I think Russia is doing pretty well as well to date. So there isn't a very strong pattern. And of course, you have Boris Johnson in Britain, who sort of flipped 180. So first it was a very bad response.
Well, he got it. Obviously, he's going to flip when it affects him personally.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, Bojo is actually clever. So he got a 2-1 in the classics at Oxford University. If you're stupid, then you're not getting a 2-1 in classics from Oxford. That doesn't surprise me too much. I'm not seeing a clear pattern. You have leftists who are doing very well, but you also have leftists who are doing badly. So Mexico, for instance, they're ruled by a socialist type, but he is encouraging people to go hug each other. Funnily enough, I thought that Belarus would do quite well, because it's an authoritarian country, and Lukashenko is like this collective power manager person, But actually, they've kept the borders open and there's no quarantines of any sort. And ironically, even the Ukraine is taking it a lot more seriously than Belarus, which is not something I was expecting.
And the Ukraine probably has more people working in other parts of Europe, like Italy, than Russia, so that's probably a factor.
Oh yeah, that's a very big problem, and I pointed it out in my article, raising the alarm on Ukraine 2 weeks ago now, on March 19th, the Ukraine is testing far too few people. It's only done 2,000 tests to date, and 600 of them were positive. No, sorry, 300 of them were positive. So that's a very bad ratio. It's just that they're not catching tons of cases. And the bigger problem, potentially, is that they've got 2 million gastarbeiters in Western Europe who are all going to be fired right now. And actually, as it so happens, the region which sent more people than any points into Italy, it's also the Ukrainian region, which is the epicenter of the outbreak there. So they had 70,000 people in Lombardy. Ukraine is actually, I believe, the only country which didn't only ban entry to foreigners, but to its own citizens.
As far as the political positions that are vindicated, it seems to be like nationalism in stronger borders, but combined with more left economic views, such as free healthcare and a UBI. So some people on Twitter were kind of joking, like Nozbol.
I suppose that's the sort of ideological positions that would be most strengthened by Corona Chan. Nothing to add there.
As far as the blame on China, well, obviously it did originate in China, but as far as what conservatives will say is they'll call it Wuhan virus and the Kung Fu flu, and then the woke left will say that's racist against Asians. Do you think that a strong blame should be placed on China, or do you see Republicans and Trump using China as the scapegoat?
Well, I mean, I think I made it pretty clear that my opinion is the latter. On the other hand, my opinion doesn't matter very much. So objectively speaking, for the sort of mega strategists, blaming China is, they don't really have any other choice because they screwed up their own response so badly that they need to blame somebody. Now, I mean, obviously, China didn't do things perfectly. They didn't identify what was happening at the beginning very accurately. They even arrested some of the people who were raising the alarm in late December, early January. There's lots of things that China could be criticized for, but at the end of the day, it's elites who messed up genuflecting and ascribing their failures to somebody who, well, can't really respond.
And we also talked about in our last show these HBD theories. So initially, there was this theory that coronavirus only genetically impacted Asians, and that's obviously not true as things are now, as Italy and the United States is being devastated. One theory I heard that was interesting is in Europe. So one example, I'm sure you've seen this as well, it showed Switzerland, and it is showing that the French and Italian parts of Switzerland are being heavily impacted, but not the German parts. So there's some other theory going around that Mediterraneans are more susceptible as opposed to Northwest Europeans. But are you still skeptical of those HBD theories?
Let's say skeptical, yes, because if you think about it, in Switzerland, which of those regions would you guess have the most intense contacts with Northern Italy? I would imagine the Italian-speaking ones. So I would also assume, based on that the epidemic is on average older in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland than in the German-speaking part, for obvious reasons. On the other hand, I'd be very surprised if there weren't some minor differences in susceptibility to coronavirus amongst the different races and ethnic groups. In particular, the Mediterraneans, they're physically weaker than Northern Europeans, and they've got a significantly lower lung capacity, and they also smoke a lot more. And it seems that like lung function is a major variable for susceptibility to death from the coronavirus. Possibly yes. All else equal, Italians would die 25% more frequently than say Germans from corona. Differences made by different policy responses are much greater, obviously.
As far as which demographics are impacted, it did seem initially it was impacting the wealthier more, and there was this major epidemic at the ski resorts in Wyoming and also in Vail, Colorado. And looking at some of these regional maps in New York and LA, so initially a lot of the cases in LA were more common on a lot of the wealthier areas on the west side. But it seems that in the very beginning, it impacted the wealthy more, and now there's more cases. There's regional maps of New York, too, and the Queens and Brooklyn are impacted much worse than Manhattan. So it does seem, in the beginning, it impacted the wealthy more, and now it's impacting the poor and the working class more, because obviously the wealthier, the ones who were able to escape the initial wave, they're much more able to better quarantine themselves.
Hey, I mean, that's all logical. And actually, funnily enough, Russia had the exact same pattern. So here in Moscow, there was also a map of the corona cases in Moscow. And there were back when there were 400 of them, there were like 100 of them in the center and another 100 in the wealthy southwest and only a dozen or so in the southeast, which is the prone area. It correlates with the people who were flying to Courchevel in France as opposed to Sochi in Russia, or not flying at all.
Joel Kotkin wrote an article predicting this. We touched on this on our last show about the impact in urbanism. So on one hand, well, he predicts that this is going to be really bad for urbanism, and it could lead to more suburban sprawl. People in New York and San Francisco, Washington, D.C., London, major cities, considering leaving the cities, moving to the suburbs, it could accelerate urban sprawl, so there's that trend. But it's really hard to say. Some people are saying that New York's urban nature is what, and public transportation is what contributes to that. But on the other hand, so Hong Kong, Singapore, and Japan, South Korea, they're very dense and urban, and they've done relatively well quarantining this. In the United States, Santa Clara County and Westchester County are suburban, and suburban Seattle, so suburbs have been impacted as well. How significant is the suburban-urban divide, and do you think this pandemic could have a negative impact on urbanism and contribute to suburban sprawl?
No, I think that's nonsense, because serious pandemics happen about once a century, and frankly, most people will just start forgetting about it in 2 or 3 years. When you decide where to buy a house, you're thinking of schools if you have children. If you don't, you're thinking of entertainment options, ease of access to amenities, and so on. Survivability in case of pandemic or in case of nuclear war isn't one of the things that enters normies' calculations. That's the first point. And the second point, and I think you alluded to it, is that it's really policy that's king. Policy and social behavior, not the physical infrastructure. Because at the end of the day, suburbia has lower densities of people, but on the other hand, if you're sending children to schools, then they're still sharing the germs. If you're going to work, then you'll still be sharing the germs. These and if you have to go to work because of the economic system, because you can't use your sick days, you've only got 5-6 days a year, and if you need to stay longer, then you need to start using your holidays, which few people are going to do in the US. Then this alone like cancels out any advantages that you'd get from suburban infrastructure and cars and so on.
And now it's starting to spread into rural areas, especially in the south.
Yeah, sure. I mean, what matters is when you come into contact with people. It doesn't, as we see, the fact that you're on average located 50 meters away from another person as opposed to like 20 meters. Isn't really a big deal if you still need to get together at work, if you're still going to church, if you're still sending your children to schools. So all of that, these sort of abstract things like population density or like how far the houses are away from each other, it's pretty irrelevant. I mean, even if you live in really densely populated blocks, then and you pass by somebody, the chances of getting infected from a passerby when you're like going up a staircase, they're still very low because the contact is fleeting, which is the sort of thing you'd get living in a big, densely populated city like in East Asia, Moscow for that matter. It might be entirely close to zero in suburbia. But what matters is when you get into close and extended contact with people, like at meetings, schools, and so on.
Moscow is now on lockdown. Do you have any observations on the situation in Moscow since the last time we talked?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been slowly clamping down on everything. So the for instance, my gym closed about a week ago now, and I started working from home, so I work part-time at the scientific institute, so we moved to work from home in mid-March, so it's all been pretty gradual and correlated with the number of cases.
And overall, how significant is the growth rate in Russia? What are the successes or shortcomings of the Russian government's policies?
I think the ultimately the main shortcoming is that is the, and I mean I think it's common to the entire West, is that there's people that were not wearing masks in near the numbers that they should be. So I'd say, I mean, in fairness, this was several days ago, so I think it's gone up sharply, although I wouldn't know because I haven't been outside. But when I went to a, last time I went to a shop, I'd say 5% of people were wearing masks. And so you really need to increase production. Russia plans to produce 3 million masks by the 1st of April. But in comparison, Taiwan produces 13 million masks per day, even though its population is 6 times lower.
Do you have any thoughts on how the pandemic could permanently restructure society and the economy?
Well, I think that the people who've been sort of pushing for more surveillance, more like facial recognition, technologies and so on, they'll be pretty strongly vindicated. In terms of politics, as I said, there'll probably be a shift to the left because people do not generally like to go of entitlements once they receive them. I mean, perhaps that's one of the reasons that the U.S. doesn't want to go full hog on UBI, is because if it does, are people going to want to let go of it once the epidemic goes away? Well, I mean, that's one factor that one might want to consider. And obviously, I think you'll see a very big rise in Chinese influence to the detriment of the US, because the US has been flailing and isn't responding well to it, whereas China has controlled its epidemic in February. Now it's provisioning aid to the entire world, so it's now going to give 1 billion masks to France, for instance. It's pretty much taken over the containment efforts in Serbia. I mean, that's going to be a very big step forwards for China's One Belt, One Ring initiative.
Before I wrap up the show, do you have any more predictions on what to expect over the next month?
I've placed myself for a tenfold increase in cases in the U.S. and many more deaths. I mean, I'm assuming that April is the month at which ICUs will start becoming overwhelmed across multiple U.S. hotspots. So New York would be the obvious one, but also Florida, Louisiana. I think Michigan is doing pretty badly. My standard recommendations is, you don't want to catch the coronavirus, so reduce the contacts, even if you're young, because from everything I've read about it. So when they say that 80% of cases are mild, 15% are severe, and 5% are critical, by mild, they don't just mean it's a cold. It means a hardcore flu in which you have trouble breathing, but I mean, yeah, it's mild relative to getting hooked up to a ventilator, but it's still a very unpleasant experience from what I've been gathering. So yes, wash your hands with soap and don't shake hands with people if you don't have to. Wear a mask. If you can't buy masks, then make a DIY mask. There are many resources on how to do that on the internet.
Anatoly Karlin, it has been an excellent show. Thank you for being on, and stay safe, everyone.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Stay safe as well.